Experimental Intermediate series. And tonight we have the great pleasure to bring you Benton C. Bainbridge directly from Erie, Pennsylvania, who drove all the way here today and just got here half an hour ago. So enjoy. He's going to tell us all about his new space there and about his work for the last 30, 40 years, right?
Yes, indeed. Check 1, 2, 3. You good? Check, check. Awesome. Hey, thank you so much, Catherine. And I'm really thrilled to be here and honored to be part of this series and also in such great company of all the folks in the room. So for those who are watching from afar, I will just say that I'm going to show a number of different videos, and I'll also describe them as they're playing, so you won't hear so much sound, because I want to make this friendly and a good experience for people who are seeing the feed and are not. In the room here at Various Artists, we have many people who have been involved with Feed Media Arts Center, showing there, helping to build Feed, and also, just coming by and hanging out at Feed. So Feed Media Arts Center is a pretty young space. It's just over 3 years old at this point. And what we're showing on the screen right now is there's a live feed, a couple of live cameras from Erie, Pennsylvania. In one of the cameras, you can see a view of the main street of downtown Erie with people passing by, and then a little stage with these found 3D letters up above it that read Cafe Giant. And this is a stage where it's open. And so just a couple minutes ago, some local comic just jumped up on the stage and started telling jokes to a small audience of people there. And that's like live streaming all the time. So for anybody who's interested in checking out Feed and seeing what we're up to, we're working towards simultaneously existing IRL and URL, right? So we want to at all times be, sharing the work of artists in our community, both locally in Erie, and, for anybody who chooses to tune in. Our main places to check out what's going on at Feed is our website, which is feed.art. The live streams and like our videos and, different things that artists make and offer, including music and videos, are primarily hosted through feedart.bandcamp.com, which is where this live stream is happening. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about what I want to cover in this next hour, which is I do want to tell you all about Feed, even with all these people in the room who have some who have shown at Feed or otherwise participated with Feed. There's a lot of things happening all the time because it's starting to reach a point where it's growing up and people are jumping in and like doing their own initiatives. So I'm going to cover a bit of Feed, show some works that have come out of our first 3 years there, and talk about where we're going. The description of tonight's talk talks about like how I'm going to talk a bit about the work at Feed, but also talk about work that myself and my collaborators have done over the years, with a particular focus on spaces where things happen, right? Because just in general, I personally feel like there's a real, right now with all this going on in the world, sometimes I'm like, if I put my foot down, is the earth going to move? Is it going to shift? Like, what stability is there? And so right now, I'm both kind of taking some time to think about spaces that nurtured us, the many people again in this room and perhaps listening, but also like collaborators and friends and colleagues. And perhaps with, you know, maybe we can think about, well, how do we continue to persevere and preserve some of these efforts right now when so much seems to be under attack, right? And so then the other thing I'll talk about a bit is I want to kind of maybe cover a couple things that maybe even some of you, you know, I've known for decades now might not even know about. So kind of cover a few things that are like, you know, maybe lesser known aspects of what I and my collaborators have done because, again, of this sense of like, you know, the archival preservation effort is a part of what we're doing at FEED. And so, you know, just to prepare for today, I haven't had that much sleep because I was wrestling with tapes and trying to find, you know, find stuff, first of all, but, you know, equally try to decide, like, how close to the edge is this mini DV tape, you know? And so I had to make some choices to capture some things we'll look at tonight. But honestly, and I'm sure many of you are dealing with this as well, right? There is a sense of like, well, if I play this now, can I ever play it again, right? So so again, I want to cover just a few things that aren't as maybe as well known. So this is not going to be any sort of greatest hits or even like deep cuts or whatever. And it's hardly a comprehensive talk about this subject of these projects and collaborations and spaces that supported them. But at the same time, I just want to kind of get some of these stories out there. All right, so that's where we are right now, like literally this minute, maybe with like a whatever, 10-second delay. So I'm going to go back and share a couple things. My story is that I'm very much a product of, you know, both nature and nurture, and that's like family and community, but also it's, you know, like a product of these institutions that were around and actually government supported, which is another whole subtext to the talk here, right? About like these things that we've decided collectively not to support anymore. And just utterly dismantle. So my mother is an artist. My father was an electronics and computer engineer. And so, you know, my father would say, like, I guess the apple didn't fall far from the tree. Maybe it's a hybrid tree or whatever, right? But, you know. But also, I had that influence that from, you know, growing up with art and technology that led me to here. But I will also say that the culture when I was a kid, when some of us were kids, was very rich. You know, so public television, which as of a few days ago, there's more explicit talk about dismantling NPR and PBS and whatnot, right? But you know, that I learned a lot as a young kid. We're talking like six is when I have memories of this specifically. So I learned a lot as a kid from this kind of stuff that was being shown on public television, ranging from children's shows like Electric Company. And that was, of course, like reading and writing, but it was also, I learned about like cultures that I, you know, didn't, that were a little bit afar, right? Like my experience, I was born in Cleveland and grew up in Erie, Pennsylvania area, both in like the city of Erie, the suburbs of Erie, and country and small town around there. But, you know, like many, I basically also grew up in New York because I was watching Sesame Street and whatnot, right? But the other thing significantly is that I was exposed, here's what I'm looking for. It's not chronological in this view. So anyways, here's the playlist I'm looking for. So the other thing is that I was exposed to like this crazy technology that they were using for children's television. So a big part of my aesthetic that I was inspired by was that aesthetic of the early analog computers in children's television workshop programming. And then also PBS had a ton of video art and other kinds of art on it, right? And then finally, even though Erie is a very small town, I grew up with a lot of art around. There was like kinetic art, performance art, and like underground comics are just a few of the art forms that were around and of a very high caliber. And also there was experimental film around. So I saw like as a kid, as a teenager, I saw like Maya Deren and Stan Brakhage and you know Bruce Conner and Bruce Bailey and all these different artists along with a ton of other stuff growing up. So I'm just going to play. So by the time I was a teenager, I was already... I will say, while this is playing, I'm going to also say I was also influenced by, like, at that time, pop culture had a lot of kind of multimedia aspects to it, right? Like, ranging from Devo would not have bands opening for them when they did tours. They would show films, and the filmmaking was a big part of their work. Laurie Anderson was, integrating performance art and sound art and as well like video art into her works. And me and my fellow teens growing up basically in the country, we all had an awareness of all this. And then finally, like the technology was beginning to become accessible at this time. So this is me, I'm probably like 17 here. And so I'm showing a video that was shot like on a VHS tube camera in a high school gymnasium. And so me and my friends would do multimedia performances when we were like teenagers in this tiny little town, you know? And to us, it was just kind of like, that was just the thing, you know? This was just like part of what life was at that time. And so this particular thing that I'm showing is my stepfather, who was actually an art history professor, another influence on me. My stepfather was really into like taping movies. He would go to the movie store, the video rental store is what I'm trying to say, and like check out VHS tapes. And then he would like make copies of like three of them on super long play onto another tape. So he had two VCRs, and so I would just tape a bunch of TV and do things like chop up loops of TV commercials to make excerpts. So this is a performance here with, there's like multiple TVs on carts and I was playing back videos from VHS tapes, and there's projections, slide projections. I made all these slides with like phrases from commercials and whatnot. And then... I'm walking around kind of directing it. So I'm in like a white shirt. I think I got cleaned up for this because normally I had like kind of a mullet long hair. And then I made all these costumes and stuff. My friends helped me out. I made there's people running around in Barbasol costumes and like a go-ahead candy bar and stuff. And then there's, I worked with, the local scene was actually very accepting, like, of a kid. You know, I was just a teenager, but, like, local artists, these were older, you know, actors / performance artists, and they came up, and I gave them a script of all these different things that I wanted them to say that were basically excerpts from TV commercials. So I'm going to keep jumping around. I will say that if anybody wants to see more, all these videos I'm going to just show you little clips of. They're all in this playlist on my YouTube. It's Benton C. Bainbridge is the YouTube channel. And the playlist is called Experimental Intermediate Presentation. So if anybody wants to see more, just go there. Now, the other thing is, like, you know, I swear to you, like, my friends were all, like, less, they were way more open-minded now. Like, a lot of them kind of, like, you know, got out of this kind of mindset of, like, experimental media afterwards, and ended up doing, like, more kind of conventional bands and whatnot. But here, this is a sort of, like, weird, like, happening kind of performance, you know, which is also an influence for me and my friends. We were really into that kind of idea of the more, like, the Rauschenbergian, you know, oh, my gosh, Billy Kluver was, EAT kind of thing of, like, you know, colliding all these different things together and happening. People like a happening, like a Capro happening or whatever, of like also of like kind of independent elements all happening once. So what's happening here is, and this I will turn up for a minute, just a little bit. So what's happening here is there's my friend who's still, we you know, continued collaborating, and we're still very good friends, who goes by Bulk Foodveyor now, is reciting a poem that's like definitely very Burroughs influenced, but also influenced by my stepfather, who would, like, when he got drunk, would just kind of speak in tongues as like this thing he liked to do. So Bulk Foodveyor would, like, write down all these phrases, and he made this poem that he's reciting. I have two other friends playing music. One's playing, like, atonal guitar, another's drumming. And then you can see in this shot, if you see, like, a steady motion there to the screen right and below the person speaking, you can see, I forget who it was, I'll remember it at some point, but I just had one of my friends, I said, just sit on the floor and clap the entire time. That's what I want you to do, and don't stop. And then my other friend, Steve Graham, who's not with us anymore, you see the weightlifter there? He was a wrestler and a real-life Dadaist. I mean, he just lived his life Dada. But basically, I just said to Steve, okay, I want you to, like, just, you know, work out the whole time. So that's what we did in high school. And we actually had pretty good audiences for this. Some of these things you really can't do anymore, especially like how we concluded the piece. At some point, I think it was, who was it? Maybe it was me doing it. At some point, like, we started pouring flour over the heads of people, and then the performance ends. And you really cannot do this anymore. But here comes Steve Graham. He's asking me, is this time to do it? And so he pulls out a cap gun and starts shooting blanks. Yeah, no, you can't do that anymore. Anyways, but people dug it. Here, they're clapping. They love it. What can I say? That was like a different era. That would be approximately 1983. So, yeah, and I have one other thing to say about that. Oh, yeah, which is that, you know, you really wouldn't be able to do it at my school, because that our school, General McLean High School, was one of the first places where there started being these mass shootings, right? So we had, I think this was approximately 97. That would have been 13 years after I graduated high school, right? Yes. Okay, so unfortunately, like, one of the first shootings that, you know, are unfortunately way too common now happened in my school. But it's a very rural kind of area, so, like, guns are just very normal. They're in the back of pickups and whatnot. And so it would be normal for people just to come to school with after hunting or whatever, right? But now, no, that is not normal anymore. That's not done anymore. So the point I'm trying to say about all this is, like, it was a really rich era. It was a really, like, public schools are really great as far as, like, nurturing creativity and independence. And, you know, as you saw, like, people are basically into this weird noise show, right? Performance art noise show in this small town. And the other thing I'll say is that the ideas that we were all focused on, like, they basically dominated the next dozen years or so of, like, the kind of work that I was doing. So I'm going to jump around a lot and just say there's, like, a whole lot of stories of New York. I came to New York, like, the next year to go to school at NYU. One of my classmates is here in the audience, Steve Zasner. And so, you know, like, I came to New York mainly because even though it was a creative environment there in Erie, that when it came down to media art, that was just something that, like, the older established artists were not into it at all. And they were just like, no, this is not a thing. So basically I was told there's no audience for that kind of work. And I was told, you know, you're going to have to leave town for that. So I came to New York. And so in New York at that time, so this is like the mid-80s, I'm just playing a video right now of the gas station, which was a place on Avenue B and 2nd Street in Lower East Side, the Lower East Side of New York, of Manhattan. It was also called Alphabet City. And so a good friend of mine and a couple people, I'm friendly with, but, you know, I'm not as close with, they established this place called Space 2B, and everybody called it the gas station. And it was a real trip back then, is all I have to say. Like, you know, many of you know this and experienced all this, but, like, basically this is the site of a former gas station where the predominantly there was this group of welders called the Rivington School, and they just kind of took it over, and just all this junk that was lying around New York, they would just make all these sculptures out of it, including, like, a fence around the property. And this was part of our scene. You know, again, like, I found, actually, New York was pretty welcoming, actually, you know, like, so as a nobody artist, within the first year of being here, I was, like, showing at Danceteria, showing my experimental films, and so Ruben Garcia, who was one of the people running Gas Station, was really into what me and Bulk Food Bear, the one reciting the poetry, and all of our friends and collaborators were doing. So we showed a lot of stuff here, and there was a lot of great art in this space. Now, man, I wish I had more time, but in any case, I can see it's already, like, I got a lot, I gotta hurry this up. So. Well, I want to cover a lot. So this was the environment in New York, and I'm not trying to say this was, like, without its issues. If anything, I'll say for people who... Oh, I didn't describe what's on the screen. So basically, on the screen is a lot of metal junk that's been welded together, like found metal, some of it carved into different things. Right now we see, like, a guitar that also has, like, what looks kind of like a spinal column cut out of metal, and then, like, a mannequin hand on top of that. And this is all welded into this building. In this fence was also welded a lot of found stuff, like refrigerators, a motorcycle, an entire car was welded. You see that? Oh, yeah, you all see the car, right? So, and tons of, like, barrels and whatnot. So, this was the kind of spirit of what I and my collaborators and friends were, you know, pursuing, this idea of, like, multimedia performance art, and within this kind of context of, like, collaging the environment around us, which was very raw and decayed. But it was also not very popular at that time. Like, in the art world, what the focus was in the high art world was basically a sort of structuralist approach to moving image, right? So basically where all the moving images are texts, and so people would do a lot of like sampling of stuff like I did with the TV commercials, right? But it was more in a kind of academic approach to the medium. And there are great works that came out of that, which, you know, I can watch Dara Birnbaum pop transformation, like, you know, forever. But also it was frustrating to me because I and my collaborators, we really wanted to like wrestle with the medium itself. We had this idea of like performing the medium. A professor of mine at New York University, I was in the undergrad program, the Tisch School of the Arts Film and TV undergrad program, and a professor of mine, Reynold Widener, told our class, experimental film and video class, about this place called Experimental TV Center in upstate New York. Oh, I have to add this one to the playlist. Oh, no, I did. Oh, look at that. Oh, I did that in a pause in the drive up here. So anyways, it took me forever to find it. For some reason, I had it uploaded to my YouTube, and I never made it public. But this is a piece. Once we found this, once I was told about this, I applied for a residency there. And Sherry Miller Hocking and Ralph Hocking, they gave me this residency. And I invited friends up to pursue this idea of like creating, you know, continuing to do what we were doing in high school, right? To continue like exploring, like making this media live and manipulating the medium. So this is a piece that's actually made at Experimental Television Center, which is, it was a studio in a loft in upstate New York, Owego, New York, outside of Binghamton. And in this studio, it was filled with like a lot of gear that was like just a little bit older, like TV studio gear, and then a lot of custom gear that was designed predominantly by a creative technologist by the name of Dave Jones. So Dave Jones was involved with the medium from a very early time. He basically, in the early days of Portapacs, like the portable video recorders that you would plug the cameras into, he was figuring out how to do batteries for that so that, you know, people could shoot longer. And so here's another example of something that the Experimental TV Center emerged from the State University of New York, the SUNY system, and it was originally part of the Binghamton campus, but then Ralph Hocking and Sherry Miller Hocking, they made it independent some years after. So what is showing on the screen, for those who can't see it, is colorful abstractions interspersed with shots in black and white from a weird angle of like this cardboard tube with a mannequin head on it and artichokes taped to it that's on like this wheeled kind of a, this wheeled, I guess it was, I don't know what it was. It was like some sort of like wheeled like coat rack or something. And so there's a slinky connected to that we have a contact mic hooked up to. And so Bulk Food Bear, what he's doing is he's taking the slinky and like kind of moving this thing around, and as he like pulls and, you know, slaps the slinky, the sounds from that are triggering the cuts between the different cameras and signals. So the signals, this is really, you can really see it well here, where like as he bunches up the slinky spring, throws it to the ground, and then it cuts the camera, right? So so this work here uses a lot of this custom technology that Dave Jones was developing. And this was in an era that was really before a lot of the technology had evolved to have like presets or to be like at a sort of more prosumer level. Ah, so this is a two-part piece. And we were very amused by this shop back there that was on its last legs. I swear to you, we didn't, it was already on its last legs. Sherry Sherry Miller Hocking was not surprised when we said that we killed it. But basically, the performance composition is just, this is actually a composition that we're realizing a performance of. It's basically that, like, we would just have this A part, which is like using the cutting between the different cameras and synthesized signals. And then the B part is it alternates between this vacuum cleaner on its last legs and people, and we're just eating, right? And so all the people who are part of this are on a black and white camera and they just eat. And so what we were doing to pull this off is we had these round robin, everybody had to be on camera and eat. And so what we would do is we would all kind of do like musical chairs or whatever, musical roles, I guess, where, you know, you would have to be on camera, then you would run, like, and during the time that the vacuum cleaner was run, you had to get into place and then start eating and blah, blah. So this is actually collected on the multi-disc experimental TV center anthology, DVD anthology, which is maybe why I decided not to publish it. It's just been up there the whole time. So anyways, you see these different people in black and white eating. So this kind of mindset was really the focus for like the next few years. Experimental Television Center, for those who don't know, it was in existence for about 40 years. And
the first resident was Nam June Paik.
That's right. And the second resident was S. Walter Wright.
Yes.
Who was actually another person who's done a residency at FEED. So basically this is a program. If you wonder what your tax dollars go to, well, maybe this is a bad thing to show people and say this is what your tax dollars go to. But, you know, but I think the significance here, though, is that I think it's pretty damn funny, personally, but, you know. But beyond that, I think the significance is that this approach to making media art that was very much out of fashion at that point. So Sherry and Ralph and the whole team there, Hank Rudolph, and the support of our state and federal government actually made it possible for this form of art that a few of us were interested in to just keep going on, even though it was very much out of fashion at that point. So that's Experimental TV Center, which is now gone, but as we were talking about before the camera started rolling, before we started live streaming, there is a new place, well, newer place that emerged in a WeGo called Signal Culture, and Dave Jones and Hank Rudolph are both involved with this space, and they were away in Colorado for years, but they're actually now going to come back and bring this back to the Binghamton WeGo area. So I'm going to now jump to San Francisco. This is all sort of out of order here. Da-da-da-da-da-da. So we were in New York, me and Bulk Fouvert and all the people you saw in that project, which includes Naval Cassidy, Chad Strohmeyer, and Andrew Kuntz. We were all in New York, but then Bulk Fouvert and I ended up on the West Coast to pursue these kinds of projects. And in the San Francisco Bay Area, we had a project called Lord Knows Compost. Actually, it wasn't me. It was my pseudonymous counterpart, valued customer, who was the one in this group. And then what you see here, this is a loft in South of Market called art space called SOMAR. And this was a benefit for Burning Man in 1995. And this was actually one of our last shows that we did out there. So basically, Lord Knows Compost was a loose ensemble or collective, and the membership would change over time, though basically Bulk Fouvert and Value Customer were the core members. And so this was, you know, kind of a continuation of the performance style. I'm just going to kind of scan through and just say, like, it was really a blend of, like, what we were developing in New York and stuff that we developed in San Francisco. But all of it basically had its roots in that high school, still in that high school collaborations that we were all doing. But Lord knows Campos was really obsessed with things like mummified animals that we would find and whatnot. So we were basically in outrageous costumes, doing live, kind of like live TV studio mixing with then emerging technology, because that was the goal of Experimental TV Center, those many of you know, was to actually say, like, look, we want, this is an art form where the tools are inaccessible, but what we want to do is to foster an environment where media artists can actually have their own studios and, you know, tools in their own hands, their own tools, and then to develop the works. So we started, we embraced that ethos, and, like, we were getting, the work you see here is largely made with, like, Amiga computers and emerging kind of technology that was like this prosumer kind of stuff that people would use for, like, you know, sort of higher end home videos or for, like, wedding videos and stuff like that, right? And so it is showing on screen. I'm just kind of scanning through this performance in 95 in San Francisco for a Burning Man benefit. And it's like kind of abstract, colorful, abstract patterns that are coming towards your face with, like, these different puppets that are made out of, like, false eyes and, you know, motorized body parts and whatnot, or anthropomorphic looking stuff. And then a lot of this footage is actually like stuff like the car washes stuff that I shot in New York. But in general, like, all of us were really into celebrating. We thought of ourselves as sort of like, you know, punk rock, celebrating the you know, rough and dirty and available, even though actually it was like, it wasn't as cheap, this technology, you know, but we still, like, found it secondhand. And so what now is showing is, like, it's alternating between these close-ups of a car wash with the flapping cleaning cloths or whatever, right, the cloth strips, and then these shots of a mouse eating a brownie in extreme close-up, and it's... And now there's a mummified cat that Balk Foodveyer found in his in his basement. And there's a shot of a Hershey's Kiss on the end of a paper clip that's being lit with a lighter and put into a belly button. And so, yeah, that's the kind of stuff we were into. So, and then also, this is the stuff that we did at Experimental TV Center here. We were just really into, like, using anything we could find and, like, making art out of. This is stuff made with the Jones, this shot is made with the Jones sequencer, which was a way to sequence between inputs. That's what was being used for to trigger the cuts with the sound for that earlier piece, We Machines. But you could also sequence within the frame. So Dave Jones, you know, would give you many different options for, like, subdividing the image and collaging it and controlling it. And the power that, that his tools and tools like the Amiga gave you at that time was really astounding, actually. All right, I think I'm going to just show you... Oh, I did want to show you one thing because it ties into the next thing. Okay, so, yeah, so this piece here, I'll just play a little bit with the music. It starts with the American flag, and I muted it. Oh my gosh, it's muted. And it's got, like, you know, marching band music going on. And this, just so you, it's not obvious, we're, like, doing things like moving these things under cameras, and people can see, this is in this very performative way, chopping up stuff and triggering these samples on the Amiga computer and stuff like that. So, Bulk Fouvert would collect all these old photographs and put them on these motors to spin them around to make these composite humans. So what all this is like very early sampling technologies that were just becoming available in that general time period. There's one more thing I want you to see here. Oh wait, where is it? There it is. Okay, hang on. Okay, so it goes from the mummified cat. Oh, some of these sounds are from, there was a company called OSC at that time. This is like early kind of Silicon Valley period, right? There was a company called OSC that stood for Our Stupid Company. And they were innovators of multi-track audio editing software for the Mac platform. And we were working with them. We would actually like promote their show, their software. With performances like this, believe it or not. And so a lot of these sounds are from like sample packs that OSC would release that was called Poke in the Ear with a Sharp Stick. And then they commissioned us, Lord Knows Compos is the name of this project, they commissioned us actually to make a whole set of like VJ samples, but we didn't use that term then, but basically all these clips that... Unfortunately, the company got sold, and the new company was only interested in their multi-track.
That was thrown to the inside of my mouth.
All right. If you say so. Here we go. Okay, so now, that was kind of the end of this period that, many of you don't actually know about. So after that, I came back to New York about half a year after that. And then in New York, let's see how we're doing. So we're about 45 minutes in. So in New York, I was... Oh, wait. I'm sorry. I'm going to say one more thing about the Lord Knows Compos and the whole scene out there. So... like any art scene, there was a lot of spaces there, and very often, artists would open up their spaces for other artists to perform in, right, or to create in, and many of these spaces are gone now. Like, I don't think Somar's around, but there were places like Commotion and all kinds of other spaces. But there are also spaces that are still around in San Francisco, many of which kind of became more official, more conventional in their structure. So I came back to New York about half a year after that. And so I came back. I'm skipping a whole bunch of stuff, a lot of projects and a lot of people and whatnot, a lot of spaces. But I had one collaborator I met in San Francisco just as she was leaving. I basically took over her space at this loft and artist complex called The Farm, where like survival research laboratories had their shops and whatnot. And so Angie Ng came out to New York, and she was interested in this idea of live video. She was a painter. And so I introduced her to the community out here that I was still coming out to New York to perform with, like Nancy Maley Walker, and at that time Eric Schefter was still here, and other people like that. And so eventually Nancy Maley Walker and Angie Ng ended up collaborating, and they had an idea of forming a group that would be all women doing live video, and they decided to invite me anyways. And So we made this project called The Pool, and the reason it was called The Pool is because we worked with a pool of musicians, right? So it was the same three video people doing live video and working with different musicians. So what's on the screen here, this is a performance at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, RPI, and wait a second, that can't be there. Yeah, okay, that's right. I was just thinking, that can't be 95. No, this is 1998. So basically, there were two musicians on camera, a keyboardist, David Weinstein, and a cellist, Jane Scarpantoni. And right now, Nancy Maley Walker and I are putting like these kind of white lab coats on each other and white gloves. And so what we were kind of like the... We were also silly, but we weren't like the kind of, you know, whatever, like vaudevillian, like, you know, dirt aesthetic that Lourdes Compost was. But we were likewise really interested in predominantly in like working with objects on camera to do these pieces that we would compose and we would actually rehearse them. Even if it looked like it was like chaos with an organized structure. So now myself and Nancy are pulling out all these objects to put under cameras, and we're basically doing like operations on them. So the idea here is the composition is essentially that you have two cameras. One is this gooseneck camera. Oh man, I need to get one of these again somehow. That came from Akihabara in Japan, in Tokyo, Japan. And it's like a camera with a heavy base, but like with a gooseneck, right? And with the head of the camera, it was designed in such a way that you could really do like these kind of swooping shots with it. And then with one hand, like maybe manipulating an object, the other hand could actually focus the ring and, or otherwise, you know, get these dramatic shots. And so that's what Nancy's operating. And then I'm operating a camera that's like an old tube camera. It's a black and white security camera, but it specifically it's like using tube technology instead of chips, which is what was really replacing that as the common technology, well, really since the 80s. And the reason that we were interested in that kind of camera is because it has a very ghostly kind of smearing image. So basically the idea was you would have like a visual representation of, you know, a hand-manipulated object, and you would have its sort of like ghost counterpart. So this piece was called Neutral Analysis. And that the sound kind of under there, Jane and David are playing on top of it, but it's like I'm hand spinning this. Does anybody remember the Environments records, the LPs that were like each side would be like kind of a soundscape in some environment, like rainforest or whatever? But there's one that I'm pretty sure Pauline Oliveros was the artist commissioned to do. It was called Tintinabulation, and it was just kind of like these bells and whatnot. And so I'm hand spinning that to make that recording and then doing audio feedback with it. All right, so this was at RPI, so which is another place that like, so Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, which is in the capital region of New York, is a place that like long for those of us who are interested in these kinds of ideas of like electronic media art, was something we all knew about because they were supporting this kind of art, teaching it and presenting it. And so yeah, and I would say out of there, I think what's valuable, besides the fact that some people who saw this performance went on to do things like make some early like VJing software, like it was called VidVox Profit, and now some of you know VDMX, which is made by VidVox. So the the creator of that company and the initial software was at this performance. And he said, oh yeah, that's great. Like, I want to make a sampler, you know? So I think that even if it's a little silly and it seems to some who might be watching this like, oh, well, what's the point of funding all this? The reality is that this is this kind of creative play, really, is what it is, actually has led to a lot of technological innovation. So I think that's why I want to see it supported, so others can continue to do so. So the I'm going to go back, actually, to Experimental TV Center now and just show you a little bit more where you can actually see a little bit more of the studio. So Nancy and I went on to create another project called NENG, N-N-E-N-G, which meant no Angie Ng, because Angie didn't want to be part of this group. Like, Angie was more focused on basically creating performance environments, and she was very interested in the presentation, and she was particularly focused on scale. To her, that's where the magic was like presenting these performances at scale. And so let's just say it was, even though it looks like play and whatnot, it was actually kind of arduous. Like, it was hard for us with the existing technology to do like shows with fast changes and all that. And there was a lot of setup in between. And so Nancy and I felt the need after we did a performance at Whitney Museum, I guess that would have been in 98 or 99, something like that. We felt the need to like really go back to less structured work and more of improvisation, which was actually how a lot of the work was birthed, right? So I'm playing video. There it is again, that gooseneck camera. I'm playing a video that is from a live performance at a place that was here in the Lower East Side called Pianos. And so this is this trio of an electronic musician and two video artists, Nancy Maley Walker and myself, making these works. So again, same kind of thing as with all the other projects, though the technology was evolving and becoming lighter weight and cheaper. You know, in the early days of what we were doing, we had to have, like, I actually bought a van in San Francisco to do the Lord Knows Compo shows with all the equipment and costumes and whatnot. So here we are now. We've gone from this live performance in New York City in the late 90s, and now we're in Experimental Television Center once again. And so here you can see better like what this environment was like. It's an old loft. It's an old, downtown in a small, very small riverfront town called Owego. Just this loft with brick walls, much like the brick walls that are in this room that we're all sitting in here. Rough-hewn wood floors. And it's just filled with a lot of gear. So Experimental Television Center, I've already introduced like the gear that was there. But in this case, we, as I said, were embracing the mission of Sherry and Ralph and Dave and Hank Rudolph. And we were starting to like amass all this equipment ourselves. And so here at Experimental Television Center, we would bring, Nancy's using a Pixel Vision camera, which was like a Fisher-Price video camera for kids that would use audio cassettes to record the image. And so it's a very lo-fi signal and it doesn't fill the whole screen. It's black and white. Here we would like basically just play together and make setups. And then we would kind of just play around until we saw stuff we would like and then record that and maybe do a little bit of editing. So you can see it's like tube TVs and a lot of kind of like industrial equipment, video equipment, and then some pretty handmade looking oscillators and other boxes to do the image processing. All right, let me see. Actually, we're coming up on 1 hour, so maybe we're not doing too bad overall in time, but I do want to get back to feed. So let me just say, I'm going to just show you a couple things from the next decade, the 2000s, so, and then I'm just going to jump and talk a little bit about feed before, you know, leaving it open for any comments or questions that anybody has. So the next decade was characterized by a transition where this hardware, people started exploring more and more, like using software, often on laptops, you know, to do image processing. And, you know, like I said, there was in RPI, there was Vidvox. That was Johnny DeCam, who founded a company after coming to that show by the pool. And so we began to see, you know, people making software in the late 90s and early 2000s. Oh, I should play this. So here's right at the turn of the 2000s. This is a sampler of Unity Game, which was a project that David Linton started. With the idea of creating a platform for presenting electronic music and visuals. And so he had a lot of ideas, and the name Unity Gain, it's a technical term that just means like when you have a digital signal, if a signal is at unity gain, it means that you're not amplifying nor turning down the signal, it's coming through at the level it came in, right? But David was also playing a nice pun on the idea of like it was a an idea that there was not like a star DJ or producer or whatever, and that like there was equal divisions of an evening where the different electronic musicians would each get a 15-minute slot, and it would cycle between them with a rotation between the musicians twice in one evening, so that if you came in at any given time as an audience member and stayed for 2 hours, you would see everybody, right? And there was no like headliner or anything, so everybody was still asking like, what time do you go on? There was like, David was like, no, there's we'll pick straws like right before the show starts, and everybody's gonna, you know, get their slot. So, and then at some point I joined him for something. And then I, you know, he and I ended up working together where I became the video curator, the curator, the VJs would participate. And there was a different structure because it was less practical for us to switch every 15 minutes. So the structure there, I don't know if any of y'all saw it, but basically we were at a place called Galapagos, which was in Williamsburg. And so David's design was that he projected to fill an entire wall, and there were two projectors, okay, and the two projectors were mirrored with one another. Well, actually, no, that was Bill Etra's idea to mirror it. They were not necessarily mirrored, just in that circumstance. And so, but the idea was that each VJ would have their own output, right, to go onto these different projectors. And the VJs were also interconnected with one another. So at any time, the VJs, a term that we only, or me and a couple other people, only kind of became comfortable using around this time, because it's still, I was like, doesn't that imply like MTV VJ? And you know, not acknowledge the fact that many of the people were not just playing content, but they were creating stuff. But essentially, VJ became the term for many of us during this time. And so the idea was that, oh, here's a good example. So basically, there are two screens side by side. They're contiguous, right, filling a wall, and each has a different image. And so the two images could be a diptych with the two performers, or it could be one of the video artists could take over both screens, or what often happened is the two video artists would send to each other, and so you could do actually process each other live, right? And then layer that with each other, and essentially that process of bringing each other up would create a feedback loop. So that was Unity Gain, and that was basically like all these musicians within the next year or two like switched from hardware to laptops, and the video artists were kind of like exploring that same thing as well, though the technology was slower. To video is always behind audio because it's more demanding of the technology, there's more bandwidth. So the imagery that I'm showing now is basically just a sampler of different artists and different video artists who were doing different things, and samples of different electronic musicians we were performing with. And the imagery ranges from like very abstract patterns that are combining colorful shapes that are kind of animated and pulsating to like real world imagery that's often very heavily processed. And these alternate with shots of the space where the things were happening, this Galapagos space in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. All right, just gonna show you a couple more things really quick here. That's a point actually that I should make though, is like, so even this stuff here that looks like, some may say this looks like animated work or post-processed, like After Effects was also becoming common during this era. This was all just like assembled live, right? So there's a shot, it's literally just being played from a tape, you know, playing it into the video mixer and layering and doing all these effects live. All right. Let us go to... That's Judy Garland there. She was talking to herself into a tape machine and complaining about it. So anyways,
I don't know how to read notes. I can't read music.
Okay, and now I'm going to just talk about... I was going to show Subtalk. That's what I couldn't do. So, you know, one of the big events, actually David called me one morning, the morning of September 11th, 2001, and he said, B, the World Trade Center is on fire. And he woke me up, and I was like, that's a really bad joke. I'm sleeping, you know? And basically he said, no, it is. And then like he said, wait a second. And so basically while he was on Essex Street, basically a bit north of here, and basically while he was on the phone, like kind of looking at this from his roof, I guess, of his apartment building, the next plane hit, and he told me that, and I'm like, okay, he's not fucking around. So I got out and I watched the World Trade Towers on fire, and so this was one of the shifts in the New York scene and in my scene here. The video that I'm showing is a collaboration with Abigail Child and Eric Rosenzweig. And so what the shots are, it's like shots inside of the subway when there was at that time like a really heavy, heavy police presence all over the place and military presence. And then the shots at times go through an effect that's kind of like a tunneling mirror effect, where every echo of the tunnel is flipped on a y-axis. So, and then over that is text that's actually quotes from Gertrude Stein that Abigail selected. So anyways, basically this era was like, it kind of, I actually wondered if it would actually kind of put New York back and set it back, because it had been, after bottoming out in that era where there was all the junk around, like, you know, a couple of years later, starting in the early 90s, it seemed that New York was ever on an ascent, right? But I thought maybe it would go back after this. But actually what happened is, like a lot of people, myself included, ended up leaving New York at this time. And then a whole new crop of people came in. And so it continued kind of going ever upwards in terms of population and restoration and whatnot. And so I'm just going to show you one last thing, which was another space in Times Square at that time of September 11th. I was actually showing this video sculpture that is, it's essentially like a video jukebox. And in that video sculpture, I made 60 artworks with a sort of analog video synthesis system that I put together at home when I had a broken leg. I broke my foot dancing, actually. Not leg, foot. I had a broken foot. I broke my foot dancing because I was a fool. I was trying to compete with a real dancer and show off. And so basically, I was stuck in the winter of 2000, like January 2000. And so I didn't have the skills to wire the circuitry together. But what I did is I found all this engineering gear that was sold at auctions from video studios. It was a time of transitions, I said. And what was happening in the commercial world is that companies were starting to gradually downsize as computers would take over the industry. And people now, people do the kind of work that used to be done in a big expensive studio with, tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars of equipment. Now that's done on laptops, right? So this is a time of transition, and I would go to auctions and I would buy this kind of more technical equipment that was more like elemental modules that would allow you to take electronic signals and turn them into real video signals, right? And so this was also an era before a lot of the classic analog audio synthesizers became really expensive. So I had, while stuck in my apartment, because it was snowy out and icy outside and I had a broken foot, I had all these classic analog synthesizers. Oh, wait, I have to pause this and tell this story. So I had all these classic audio synthesizers. And so while I didn't have that sophisticated of a video synthesis setup, I had very good analog audio synthesizers, and I would put these through, I would play them live and then make these compositions where I put the signals through this kind of broadcast TV equipment to turn these into video signals. That piece showed at Chashama, and it was a week before September 11th. I was oh, it's going to be perfect, right? Everybody's gone in August, and then they'll all come back in September, right, after Labor Day, and I'll get all these curators and, museum people to come down to see my crazy electronic abstract art, and, people are no, we're not going out and seeing anything. You're crazy. But what was really cool about it, actually, is I was in Times Square in these abandoned buildings that later became skyscrapers, the Chashama, which is still around. They're still doing the same thing. As the family gets property that will essentially become mothballed until they get the permits and the designs and everything together to do the demolish those buildings and then build new green skyscrapers and whatnot. They turn them over to the daughter of the family who runs arts event programming out of these spaces. And so at a Chashama space, I was showing these analog video synthesis pieces in the storefront. And I was honestly what does my work mean in this time when we just had a terrorist attack and thousands of people died, and now there's this militarization of the government and whatnot, right? And I was considering I should just this work is utterly meaningless. And I went to Times Square to just kind of check on it, and there were, as some of you will recall, they had stopped all the flights at this point, and there were all these tourists in Times Square who were asking me. They saw me opening up this abandoned storefront with my art in it, and they're like, "What? nothing's open. What do we do? Like, what, you know, this is my vacation and I came to New York and I can't go back home. What do we do? And I was like, oh, well, you can come in and look at this art of mine, you know? And so it ended up like we had hundreds of people coming through this. It was actually, it made me realize, you know, whatever you're doing, even if you are like, well, maybe this is silly and maybe this is not, you know, relevant. Actually, it was really, at least it was if nothing else, distracting for a lot of people. And it was, you know, quite an awesome thing to be in this war zone, right? Anyways, so this is slightly later, after things were kind of mellowing out a little bit. This is also at the same Chashama location. It's now like the Bank of America building, One Bryant Park. This is a show curated by Scott Holmquist called Exoptic Extravaganza. But basically, like, the idea of the show was that it was all artwork that was focused on, like, the idea of deflecting gaze and making not exactly ambient, right? That means something different, but more like intentionally, like, you know, deflecting gaze, right? You know, that is his theme. And I can go more into that later, but I'm going to try to wrap this up now. So, but I wanted to show this amongst other things. So I'm going to turn up the sound. So amongst other things,
look, you have to look very closely.
I see bugs. Not bugs.
Fingernails.
That's right.
So here's a sculpture with like a bunch of fingernails cast in some kind of resin. And I don't know why that's a thing with some artists.
All right, continuing around. Should I give you a whole tour?
He asked, what was the significance of the fingernails?
Well, you could ask the artist. But I actually know three people who have extensive fingernail and toenail collections. One of my friends who has a big toenail and fingernail collection keeps them in a mug in the shape of a tit.
I don't know what is it about these artists.
I'm not sure of the significance of that either. Anyways,
and so in this case, this is Chashama, and I was showing a work as part of this where the I'm going to turn on the sound now. So the curator of this commissioned a work for me where the idea. So his whole thing was like, oh, you know, people are going to get sucked into. They're addicted to media, right? They're sucked into stuff. This is before we all had smartphones, right? And he's like, this is terrible. Like, people are addicted to their internet and their TV and stuff. And so he had this whole idea that he's going to create all this media that was essentially like an antidote to attractive media. And so he asked me to make, I helped him make the first work, the sort of cardinal work in this series, just as like a tech, you know, like basically a craftsperson, right? But then he commissioned a work for me. And he's like, oh, I want something that, like, you know, brings people together. And so basically, like, you know, I did this thing and the whole idea was it was supposed to be like a video you put on that improves, that's like a marital aid. It like improves, you know, your relations with your lover and whatnot. And it was pretty funny, like media channels picked up on this whole thing and whatnot. And so in here, what, let me see if I can find it. Basically, the installation was a bed with the work projected on it. It's a little hard. The projectors were very not very bright at that time. But and then the bed had like a subwoofer underneath it and vibrations. So, yeah, that was kind of like. So I'm going to stop with old stuff there because then from that point forward, I think, like, rather rapidly in retrospect, you know, it was, so this is very late 2001 or very early 2002. And so then, you know, I basically left New York for a little bit. And so simultaneously, I think a few different trends all happened. One trend is that technology in our personal lives like really, really escalated with no longer just personal computers, but the introduction of, you know, handheld mobile phones. It was really September 11th where I personally changed my attitude about mobile phones, because I was like, you know, you would see people, I thought like, oh, it separates us as much as anything, right? But then you would see people gathered together in the streets of New York City, like connecting with their loved ones outside of New York, but they were together with each other. So I thought that was sort of positive. But then only, you know, 5 years later, the iPhone was introduced. And before that, a couple years later, the Sidekick, if anybody knows the HTC Sidekick, that was introduced. And when I was like touring with Beastie Boys, which was another thing that was happening, as my professional career kind of went away, doing editing video, like then I no longer could make a living doing that. But actually, all of a sudden, the world started understanding this idea of media art on a mass level. So basically, I think this was kind of the end of this era that is right at the cusp of where I see us substantially being at right now, where media basically, and the technology basically permeates our lives. And, you know, it seems to be, next we're gonna let AI come in and like really mess stuff up. So anyways, I'm gonna stop there from the old stuff I'm showing. It is now actually an hour and 15.
Are you gonna show any Beastie Boys stuff?
No, I don't think so. Which I thought about that, but literally the stuff that I gathered here was like this tape that I just played here from Chashama, like that took a couple of hours. It kept like falling apart. And there's a little bit at the beginning, like I didn't get it all, but it's not significant. But the tape was literally like starting to fall apart. So I focused on just getting that whole tape and these other things here, because I felt like that's what was at hand and that was what was at risk at that moment. But the Beastie Boys stuff is online. I don't have that much of it on my accounts, but yeah, the story there is basically that I could no longer make, I actually quit after September 11th. I quit my job working as a video editor in like a studio with like this kind of hardware, because I saw the writing on the wall, and I thought also that this mom and pop shop, they should evolve as well, because they couldn't sustain this business moving into this new era. And then, you know, like all these opportunities opened up. Basically, from the Unity game, a person who had been an intern of ours started dating someone who was doing the lighting and stage design for Beastie Boys and many other groups. And the Beastie Boys actually requested a VJ who would perform live using oscilloscopes, and that's work that I was doing. And so Jenny Scholder said to her now husband, you know, like, hey, you know, you should talk to Benton. And so that kind of, that they basically broke it open for a little while. I think it's actually collapsed again, where basically they don't really have live VJs in that kind of show. It's back to the lighting person is really controlling that kind of, those visuals that happen. But the visuals certainly permeate the shows now. So do you all want to, like, do you have any questions, or should I show you a little bit more about feed, or what do you, a little bit about feed, okay, so, and we'll go for, maybe I'll go for like 10 more minutes, and then if anybody has any questions, you know, we'll leave a few minutes for questions, okay. So, let's see here, feed Media Art Center. So, as I said, feed is, that's what I've been working on now. And again, many of you.
Turn off the sound again.
Yeah, I know. Let me just kill that. Bye bye. Stop talking. So, anyways, basically, the next chapter was the whole financial Great Recession and whatnot. Basically, there are so many collaborations and so many art spaces that I think I need to turn this into a multi-part talk at some point. But after the Great Recession hit, I was in a place with a group of artists on the Bowery, and it's now where Friedman Gallery is, actually, is this building. Basically, we were all trying to figure out how to survive. I'm going to just play videos in the background from feed while I'm talking. But basically, we were trying to figure out how to survive as artists. You know, typically, we're wily and can survive even with little resources and whatnot. But also, it took a lot of creativity to survive at that time. And so a lot of people were really looking at alternative ways of running economies. And so one thing that we were exploring was something called time banking, which was basically like a way, instead of exchanging money, you would actually exchange time for different skills. Exchange your skills and time, right? And out of that, some people found out about blockchain technologies and crypto. And so I saw its potential for art, for digital media art right away. And that became something I studied for about 5 years. And long story short, basically with the pandemic, some would say I was lucky, and definitely there's a lot of luck there. But basically, like, a very, very small amount of money turned into enough money to buy this place and to fix it up to the degree that we've been able to fix it up so far. And so feed, basically, you're seeing these, I'm just showing works on the screen that have been either created at feed or shown at feed. The work that I'm showing right now is this thing I mentioned to some of you in the room earlier, which is a collaboration between Jenny Bowles from Bozeman, Montana, and Stephen Moore from Chicago, and they're taking these shots from the 1904 World's Fair, presented first in St. Louis at that World's Fair. And they're shots from this factory in Pittsburgh that Westinghouse used to make turbines for electronic, big, powerful electricity generating setups, right? And so what Jenny has done with this footage is she got a new transfer from the National Archives, which is where our tax dollars go to preserve our history, and basically she got a brand new transfer of this footage, ultra high resolution, ultra high definition, and they are presenting these works at a very large scale, so you really feel like you're just in these, in this factory, in these rooms, in these halls with them. So what's on screen now is you see people in this environment. And the workers, in this case, it's a bunch of women checking in who are similarly dressed and have similar hairdos with their hair up. They're all punching the clock. And they're, like, larger than the guests who are in the room enjoying the work. So at Feed, what we're trying to do is to, create a space where people from outside of Erie can come to Erie. And basically, for young artists, well, they don't have to be young, but for any artist who, like me, wants to explore media art, they don't have to leave Erie, right? And so media artists are coming to Erie, they're presenting. Many in this room, again, for those watching outside, have already come to Feed and presented at Feed. And there's an interaction with the local artists, and there's a lot of skill sharing and passion sharing. And people also are like, the work that's showing now, the Westinghouse footage, like a lot of the local artists worked on this to help build this, right? So that's what we're showing now. We're showing, come on down, it's like a train ride away. Erie is halfway between New York and Chicago, and, so like 7.5, 8 hours, it depends on the damn traffic, of course, but be that as it may, it's far, but not that far. It's like, a day's drive or a longer train ride, and the train station drops you off two blocks from feet. So, yeah, come on down. Oh, there's Jason and Deborah of Signal Culture in their residency at Feed. So, yeah, I'm just playing a bunch of footage there, and there's so much to say about it. I don't know, what else should I say? What else should I say about Feed for those who are watching from afar? I mean, here's what I will say. It's very young, and we are... we're still, like, even with the certificate of occupancy, and we, you know, we've been officially open with the, you know, certificate, and the hall's basically fixed up, right? Even so, we're still, like, there's a lot more building to do, but now what we're doing is we're finding these different people who are coming in, and they're starting to build programs within Feed, right? These are local people. And so, for example, we have a series, a weekly, like, art rave, basically, that has been going now for nearly 1 year. And they've done it every single weekend since, in 2 weeks, it will be 1 year. Yeah. So, and so that's very exciting. You know, then the focus is, like... it is really like people VJing and live music mixing. There's the person with the headphones on is an artist who painted a 66-foot-long mural at Feed. This is Nyree Shelton. Oh, I didn't say for the audience there, it's just listening. I just put back up on screen a live feed that comes from Feed where we are working towards eventually, like, always presenting stuff on camera at the same time that we are opening the doors to people to come in, you know, in real life, right? So, I don't know, maybe that's enough. So, yeah, it's we are building. I am thankfully reaching a place where I can start kind of passing the baton because... my real life stuff is just, I have to give it all my attention. But there's, you know, a lot going on. And we are still in this kind of flexible era where we are not totally formalized yet, right? So people can come and just say, like, oh, can I come down and do this? Now, we are leaving the era where you ask me, but, you know, let's just say we, you know, the people who are taking over, like, they are hungry for you all to come and work with them. So we still don't have that much in terms of, like, formalized structure and funding and staff, though we have found a really good installation tech. This guy really makes miracles happen every single day, including hanging all those letters, the Cafe Giant 3D letters and stuff, and installing our TV garden, and et cetera, et cetera. So he hung all these screens, some of which are super, super heavy on these complicated, rough-hewn brick walls. So, yeah, so that's probably a good place for me to stop talking now that we're almost at an hour and a half and just say, does anybody have any comments or questions? We could spend another hour just talking about all the stuff that people in the room have done here. So William Laziza.
So one thing is that if we do questions...
Do we get to stop the live stream? Okay.
Yeah, we don't have a mic.
I can repeat the question, but what do you want to do? Do you want to wrap it? Okay, great. So we can just talk amongst ourselves because you all should meet each other. Thank you very much. And thank you so much, Catherine. And let's see, Scott. Yeah. Thank you, everyone.
He has a live feed of this.
Okay. All right. Now I take a sip.
I got a question.
Lay it on me.
What were you going to ask me?
I was just going to say, oh, look at that. See, I just killed our light source. Let me open up the laptop again. Yeah, I was just going to say, like, you know, anybody who doesn't know each other in this room should, like, introduce yourselves because, you know, like,